But first this morning to Gaza. A patchwork of brief ceasefires has led to relative calm on the Gaza Strip over the past 24 hours. But with more than 1,000 Palestinians killed in 3 weeks of fighting, what are the prospects at this point of a more lasting truce? Well, to look at what is at stake for Israel and Hamas in terms of any potential gains from further fighting, I'm joined now by security analyst and former British Army officer Patrick Bury and by Middle East analyst Hazir Timourian. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us this morning. Patrick, I'll go to you first of all. I mean, really at this point, it's about Benjamin Netanyahu weighing up the cost-benefit analysis of continuing the Israeli activities in Gaza. Where do you think he's going to come down on it? What's at stake for him now?
The two things, obviously, on the one side is the growing amount of public opinion around the world that wants Israel to stop and to commit to initially a shorter-term ceasefire that will then lead on into a longer-term ceasefire. So maybe a 24-hour, then a 48, and on to a week. And then they can get the Hamas and the Israel diplomats around the table and to start hammering out a proper agreement. But it's just basically to commit to a longer ceasefire. Whether he's going to do that on the one hand to placate public opinion and to maintain his relationship with the US, which it seems in the last 24 hours we've seen some of the strongest rhetoric against Israel coming out, although it was balanced and the soundbites have said, you know, they've taken the juiciest part, saying an immediate ceasefire. Obama did go on to say he does respect Israel's right to defend itself. That hasn't been made so many of the headlines recently. But there's definitely been a slight change in the rhetoric, and with Senator Kerry, then the offer that he made to the Israelis, where the Israelis saw them as very pro-Hamas. So there's a slight freezing of the relationship there in the last day or so.
The only thing is with the American thing, I mean, commentators even saying this morning, it's all very well for Obama to come out and say he wants an immediate ceasefire, but there's no stick with Israel.
No.
Yeah, and there's no prospect of it either.
You can also say there's no stick with Obama. If you know what I mean, and this has been a problem, I think, of his sort of foreign policy for the last 6 years or so. And then on the other hand, for Netanyahu, you know, the military operation, which started as targeting a limited objective, which was to stop some of the destroy some of the rocket launching sites, and also to get in at some of these offensive tunnel systems which the Hamas were using to get in and attack Israel across the border. It was to destroy some of those. Now they've destroyed a fair few of those, 31 or so. And it's whether it's worth keep going. Certainly for the next sort of dynamic of that is Israeli public opinion is about 85-90% in favour of, you know, continuing the operation, and some of them even in continuing to destroy Hamas as an organisation. So it's that balance. That's what he's weighing up.
Patrick, you've also been looking at some of the weaponry that the Israelis are using. I mean, we've seen a lot of public comments about, you know, we don't want civilian deaths. We're looking at pinpoint weaponry here. Yeah. We're trying to be as specific as we can. From your observation of what they're doing, what are they using and how pinpoint, if you like, can they be?
Well, if you look at some of the... They're using artillery rounds. They're firing, you know, self-propelled artillery guns, which have an accuracy... If you're firing in a field and you have a good flat, you know, view of the field, you wouldn't want anyone within at least, like, for safe distance, 100 metres, if they're in body armour and everything.
100 metres?
Yeah, about 100 metres. So you wouldn't call it in on your own troops within 100 metres. And obviously, they're firing them into civilian, built-up urban environments. And it's that kind of fighting. If you get a rocket attack, if Hamas launch a rocket and you've got pinpoint satellite imagery, the rocket's just been launched and you fire a guided missile straight back and it hits civilians, well, you can understand. That's the kind of thing Hamas do. They put rocket sites near schools. They want this to happen.
Yeah, well, we saw some video.
We get that. That's
the
dirty side of war. That's the dirty side of war, and that to some degree is understandable. What's not understandable is just firing unguided shells into civilian areas. Like, that basically in many books is a war crime.
So it makes a mockery of the public utterances about avoiding civilian deaths.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, to bring in Hazir Timourian, Middle East analyst, what is your analysis of where the diplomatic process is at this point? Are you interested, if you like, in what the Americans have been saying? Does it go beyond what you would have expected from President Obama?
No, I think the Israelis know that they can outlive this president. I think he's got only two years to run, and the next president is much more likely to be pro-Israeli, more pro-Israeli than he has been. I unusually go along with every word that my colleague has just said to you. I think that the Israelis are sophisticated enough to know that they are losing the propaganda battle. This propaganda battle is just as important. Israel knows that these simple, horrifying images of suffering coming out of Gaza, going to every Arab home, every family in the world, in fact, because of satellites. I've seen demonstrations being filmed and reported in Guatemala, for example, for the Palestinians, in Austria, elsewhere. And it's enraging public opinion, especially in the Arab world, and making it difficult for the governments there who have no love at all for Hamas. We've got to remember that Hamas is now virtually the only enclave ruled by a party in the Arab world that still calls for the destruction of the State of Israel, unlike the bulk of Palestine under Mahmoud Abbas, who calls for negotiations, renounced violence. So, as far as I know, only the government of Iran and Qatar, because Qatar has got rivalries with Saudi Arabia, and the Islamist government of Turkey are giving Hamas some support.
And can I ask you, I mean, reports coming out about the actual strength of Hamas at the moment, it's reported to be quite seriously in debt, it can't pay its civil servants. How important is it to Hamas, from a PR point of view, to have been involved in this conflict? Has it played in some ways to the strength of their hand?
I think it has, definitely, and that's why it's been reluctant to even observe
its own ceasefire, as Netanyahu said.
That's
yeah.
right. At the moment, it seems also there's to be another difficulty. The political internal leadership of Hamas seems to be rather weak. The shots are called when it comes to firing of rockets by the military wing. And then there is the overall leadership under a man called Khaled Mash'al, who is based in Qatar, but as at the moment is trying to get the Iranians to agree to him going to Tehran to ask for more money and for more rocket parts. And in order to please the Iranians, he's got to tell Hamas that there must be no negotiations at all with Israel about a solution to this, longer term solution to the essence of the conflict.
Gosh, that's interesting. So, I mean, Patrick, a whole other level that the political leadership of Hamas are not actually deciding what the military wing are doing.
Well, this would happen frequently in insurgencies and in any sort of uprisings. The movement itself is split, and sometimes it unifies when there is military action. And if I was a Hamas military leader or even a political leader, you would, despite the casualties, despite the horrific injuries to your people, at a strategic level, you're probably rubbing your hands in glee at what the Israelis are doing, because it's exactly what you wanted them to do. Get involved in a ground war which you'd prepared. You can kill their soldiers. We've seen the Israelis have taken the most amount of military casualties in the last 6 years, you know, in 2008-09.
Yeah, I mean, pales in comparison to the thousand
It's tiny, but massive compared, a figure of four or five compared to what they've taken before. The point being that Hamas were military prepared for this. And also, while Israel keeps shelling civilian areas, it's playing into their hands.
Just as time is running out for the Israelis in terms of public opinion, that the tide will turn for them, it's hard to believe that within Gaza, the people are not kind of looking at Hamas and going, stop firing the rockets.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, once you've lost, that's a very, very poignant point, but once you've lost families, do you become more moderate or do you become more extremist? I'd argue that generally most people's blood is up and they want revenge. And so if they see another rocket go over when they've just lost their family members, it's not yes, there's that thinking part which would be like, well, that's obviously going to have a response. But on the other hand, at the emotive level, you're like, yeah, well, let's get some revenge.
What's your take on that?
Yes, this is very important. Whenever I hear in reports a Palestinian family saying, we have nothing to do with politics, why has our home been bombed? That in Gaza, in the whole of the Arab world, is being seen as code language, as saying, I am not a supporter of Hamas. But unfortunately for the people of Gaza, since 2007, when Hamas in a military coup seized power, it has not given the people of Gaza another chance to speak. So we don't know really, in an atmosphere of intimidation and fear and also emotionality as there is now, how many people in Gaza really want this isolation and this extreme lack of reality on the part of Hamas, thinking that it can actually wipe out Israel. Go on.
Yeah, and from Hamas's point of view, I mean, you can see the Israelis are saying we want to clear these tunnels. Some would say their ultimate aim is to get rid of Hamas. But what do Hamas want here? They have the world's attention at this point. How much further do they want to take it? Or what would cause them to want to continue fighting?
Hamas are an Islamist party, as we all agree. And I don't want to be too cynical. I want to believe them at face value when they say that the quickest way of getting to heaven is to be killed in jihad for the spread of Islam. So if a lot of them believe in this, then the rest of it becomes very, very logical. In other words, if this world is not important at all, what does the suffering of 100,000 refugees matter? What matters really is eternal life.
Azir, I suppose you can see that from an individual militant's point of view, but from a leadership point of view, I mean, they must have an aim here. They must have something they want to achieve in the shorter term. They must have a little more strategy than that, would you think?
Well, for example, in Ireland, we've seen the troubles hopefully coming to an end because the IRA had a political aim. And once they discovered that they could not capture the whole of Northern Ireland, they negotiated. But in the case of Hamas, I think that possibly there is no such political aim. You cannot...
Other than the destruction of Israel.
Yes. Otherwise, Israel is being asked by them to commit suicide first before it comes to the negotiating table.
Okay, well, I mean, another thing that we've seen in recent days about this conflict is that it does appear also to be spreading. There's been unrest in the West Bank, and I am joined now on the line by Elaine Bradley, an Irish aid worker who is trying to get to Gaza but is currently in the West Bank. Elaine, thank you for joining us this morning. What are you seeing at the moment in terms of unrest or support for the Palestinians in Gaza in the West Bank?
Okay, well, obviously there's an awful lot going on here which I want to talk about, but I just want to go to the previous conversation and say that I question the entire premise on which that conversation was based. It has to be pointed out that Israel, it's not a war of two equals and two equal military powers. Israel is the occupying power, and that carries requirements under international law. They have an obligation for the health and well-being of the people who they occupy. They do not have the right to declare war on them and bomb them. And I've been working in Gaza since 2012, and I can tell you that because of the siege that has been imposed on Gaza, people there are dying fast and they're dying slow. And that is that the injustice that's been visited on the people of Gaza really underpins everything that's happening there at the moment. So, frankly, I wanted to make that. And then the second thing I want to say, what your speaker there said about Hamas calling for the destruction of Israel, it is on record that they removed that from their manifesto in 2006. This talk about wiping out Israel and going to heaven and being martyrs, that is rhetoric and it's propaganda, and it doesn't serve any purpose other than to fuel a very one-sided battle. That's in it. Which Palestinians are suffering. So if I can go back to your question about the West Bank. The West Bank is geopolitically separated from Gaza. If you've seen maps of Palestine, what was Palestine, you'll see how diminished the area has become. And it's been politically divided because there are so many different factions here, as you know. But what this onslaught against Gaza has done is it's connected everybody, and I can say that everybody I've spoken to is absolutely united, and there is a call for resistance against the occupation, and there is talk of a third intifada, and we're seeing resistance all over the place. We're seeing demonstrations, we're seeing attacks on military installations.
You're writing one of the Irish papers today. You were present at one of the marches at the weekend, and live ammunition was used.
There was a march called the 48 March, and it was intended to go from Ramallah to Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem is only about 3 miles from the Calandia checkpoint, and Calandia is on the outskirts of Ramallah. And it was a sort of mass rally, and everybody was there under one flag. Usually if you go to a rally, you'll see all the different factions under their flags. There was one flag, and it was the Palestinian flag. People are really suffering because of what's happening in Gaza, but it's not just what's happening in Gaza. You have to remember that under the pretext of the kidnapping of the three teenagers, the Israeli occupation forces went on a rampage throughout the West Bank. People are saying it was to damage the unity government that Israel didn't want. They arrested over 1,000 people. A lot of them, not all the 1,000, because they've arrested community activists and leaders, but they also arrested Hamas leadership in the West Bank. They destroyed houses and they killed 11 people in the time that the world thought that Israel was looking for three teenagers who, in fact, it's now transpired that they knew were dead within 24 hours. So that sham, and this is what I'm talking about, the propaganda, we have to stop buying into this rhetoric, the lies and propaganda, and deal with the absolute issues. And
okay.
The issue is an illegal occupation that's gone on for nearly 50 years in the West Bank.
Okay, Elaine, I just will bring Hazir Tamouri in there. Your reaction to what Elaine has been saying there?
Before I'm accused of being a supporter of Netanyahu's right-wing settler government, I must say, defend myself. I think Netanyahu and Hamas really help each other by reinforcing the fear in the other people. Secondly, if the Hamas people had removed that constitutional requirement to destroy Israel, I would have heard about it. All that they have done is to agree with Mr. Mahmoud Abbas that they will abide by the Palestinian government's international agreements. And then thirdly, there is no occupation of Gaza. There is occupation of the West Bank, yes, 500,000 settlers there. But for several years, every Jewish settler has been removed from Israel, from Gaza. And if Gaza continues, as in fact, these rockets began to fly against Israel in January, not just over the past 3 weeks. If a state does that to its neighbors, of course, what do? You blockade it if you can. You are at war. You defend yourself.
I have to cut across.
Okay, Elaine,
I really have to cut across because there is a gross inaccuracy. The UN recognizes that Gaza is occupied because occupation isn't just the physical presence. Removing the settlements in Gaza were illegal in the first instance, so that's no great concession. But occupation doesn't mean that you have your forces in there on the ground. Israel controls all the borders. It controls the air and the sea space. It controls what comes in and what goes out. And as one minister several days did, was they did what they called putting Gaza on a diet, where they calculated the daily calorific requirements and they allowed less than that amount to come in. So the tunnels became a lifeline. This is all information that's out there. It's available. International groups like the UN have written umpteen reports about this. So we have to stop building on these myths. Gaza is occupied and Israel is the occupying force. This isn't my opinion.
Okay, let Hazir Tamouri come back in on that.
I ask you, why do the Muslim Arab government of Egypt themselves impose sanctions on Gaza? They have got borders with it, and yet they are also trying to destroy those smuggling tunnels. And if the
isn't that the, about internal Egyptian politics as well, that Hamas would be seen as part of the opposition to Sisi?
No, they are seen as a foreign entity, really, it's true. And if the blockade is so complete, how is it that the Hamas people have been able to import from Iran components for 2,000 rockets at least to throw at Israel over the past 2 weeks?
Can we go back to a wider point that Elaine mentioned there, that much of this is that many analysts would say that what the Israelis are really concerned about here is some kind of a unity government between Fatah and Hamas. Do you believe that? Do you think that the Israelis have almost engineered these events in order to put a halt to that kind of unity?
No, not at all. Hamas needed money badly. It can't pay its 40,000 civil servants. It thought by entering a unity government with Mahmoud Abbas, the president, it would receive money, and Mahmoud Abbas promised money. But it didn't happen because it was supposed to go along with negotiations with Israel about the longer term peace.
Okay. I mean, final word, Patrick, I'll go back to you on this. From a military point of view, how do you see this playing out? Do you think that we are any closer to any kind of long-term ceasefire here, or will it be this kind of lull after lull in the fighting and outbreak?
Well, the military is always related to the political. Mm. So it just it runs down that way. That's the first thing to bear in mind. It's very, very hard to call, I think, Eilean. I would say, yes, you're probably going to see this round has been rejected by the Israelis almost out of hand. You're probably going to see, we know that they're very hard, it's very hard for Hamas to even hold a ceasefire given their the fractured nature of the organisations. And given those circumstances, I'd say this is going to roll on for a while yet.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to leave it there for this morning. But thank you very much indeed, Patrick Bury, Hazir Tamourian and Elaine Bradley from the West Bank for joining us.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.